There's been an event happening for most of this week over at the library, inviting local people to engage with how the town of Dunfermline might be improved. I know that this is just the latest in a procession of such events, and that for some sitting here, it will seem like the same people going over the same ideas and coming up with very little that's new. The dates for Design Dunfermline were set very recently, so I thought I might not be able to squish it in, and in fact had really decided it wasn't a priority for me. However, Ken was sent an invitation to take along an artefact that related to this congregation that said something about Dunfermline's past. Ken wasn't able to go, and I thought I could manage to fit that activity into the day. I squished it between two meetings. Our item was the book that the elders sign on the day that they're ordained. It goes back to 1702, and with a little bit of reference to the annals of Dunfermline, I was able to tie up some of the names from the 18th and 19th century. Amongst those ordained in 1745 were Andrew Dickey, the watchmaker who was involved in the new clock for the Kirk steeple. In 1776, James Christie, who had been elected the master of the Sang School. In 1801, there's William Meldrum, who was one of the committee for the Tradesman's Library and who brought a printing press in 1813 and printed texts and scripts for Sunday schools. The item caused a little interest amongst the local historians who were there, although perhaps not as much interest as St Margaret's relic that Father Chris had brought down from the Catholic Church. On Thursday evening, one of those who'd been there sent me an email that says, "I've been looking at my notes on the 18th century Abbey Kirk session minutes, 1701 to 15, and I can give you a bit of information about the 1702 elders. William Robertson of Gladley, who was leasing the coal works, was also Adam Smith's father-in-law. Patrick Angus was a bailie, Patrick Hatton was a weaver, and Hart, there's one name that's just a surname, there's also a cross, which obviously somebody who wasn't sure how to sign their name. Hart was Alexander Hart. Other elders mentioned in the minutes were Adam Rowland of Gask. Rowland Street is named after him, or either one of his descendants. Also Adam Rowland, who left money in his will to build a school, which was eventually built in Rowland Street and was where Andrew Carnegie was educated. Also mentioned are James Meldrum, Merchant, John Mitchell, John Beveridge, John Couston and David Moose. My friend Jean Barclay made some very full notes on the rest of the 18th century session minutes, and I can let you have them on my own if you'd like. Then she looked at the 1871 elders, and John McClary was the schoolmaster at the first McLean School. Robert Bald was almost certainly the man of that name who was the master at Miles Mark School. What struck me about the elders of the 18th and 19th century was how diverse a group of men they were, much like our own Kirk session today, although we do now include women. What also struck me was how embedded they seemed to be in the life of the town as well as in the congregation. And perhaps that too is similar to today. However, in telling you that, I've been straying away from what I hope to say. Having been at the event to show my object, I peered through the door where the discussion about how the town might be shaped was taking place. I was only going to pop my nose round the door for 2 minutes before a couple of folks spotted me and waved me over and pointed to the seat I was to sit in. It was a good point to join them on the second day, as they were exploring a variety of ways in which the town could be a place for both locals and visitors to remain within, to spend a day within. One of the themes that arose was Dunfermline as a city of stories. For those who might want to know a little more, I'm going to encourage you to pop over to the library between 11 o'clock and 2 p.m. today, where the Design Dunfermline event will be coming to a close, not least because you get to see all the artefacts and pictures of all the artefacts that came. I'd quite like to go myself, but there's something after the second service that I'm going to. As I mused on the time spent there, the time I was supposed to use to write this sermon, I mused upon how often we find ourselves in a place we're supposed to be when we never intended to be there in the first place. It wouldn't be the first time I've been heading in one direction, only to find that something within me suggests that I need to be somewhere else. And in responding to that, needing to be somewhere else, I've turned up at the doors of those who needed someone with whom to talk. I know that I'm not the only person who experiences that. And the only rationale I can offer is that thing called the Holy Spirit. The book of Acts describes Philip's impetus to meet the unnamed Ethiopian as an encounter with an angel. He's sent to the south where he meets an important Ethiopian because the eunuch is an official in the court of Queen Candace. When we start to fill in the missing gaps of the story, we find a remarkable story. Because we know the Ethiopian as a eunuch, we know immediately that he was probably born into a very poor family who were either seeking money for themselves or some kind of future for their son. He would have been castrated at a young age so that he would have been eligible to serve in the harem of a wealthy family, where he could safely be assigned to look after the women folk. Or he may have been a slave who'd been castrated by his master so that he could work in the women's quarters. Somehow he managed to move from the role of household servant or slave to become a court official in charge of the treasury of the queen. In the story we have of him, he is a successful man with money and the freedom to travel and study. But he doesn't fit in. On this journey, the Ethiopian has been studying the book of Isaiah, and because he's struggling to understand, Philip is urged towards his chariot to tell him more. The words that he's reading come from Isaiah 53, and perhaps they carry some resonance with how the Ethiopian felt about the life he'd been given. Perhaps he felt he'd had very little say about the humiliation he had experienced on his journey to the role he was in, and yet he still felt left alone, cast aside. The disciple begins with the text that the Ethiopian has found inspiring and soul-searching, and retells the story of Jesus. In asking to be baptized, the Ethiopian has recognized something in the story that offers him a place. Jesus' story speaks over and over again of those who are so often considered outsiders being offered a place within the story of God. Jesus' story speaks of those who feel incomplete, finding their wholeness and their well-being at the heart of God. To go back to the Design Dunfermline event, it's not just the town that needs to be rehearsing its stories. It's us that needs to be telling our stories, but also discovering that the story of Christ is not a story that we treasure and think can't move to accommodate those around us. Like the town, we have a multi-layer story. There's the story of this 19th century building that we're immersed in this bicentenary years. There's the story of reclaiming the Christ story for everyone at the Reformation. There's the story of the building of David's church. There's the story of Margaret and the building of a monastery. There's the story of the Caldee community. And there are our own individual stories, all of them shaped around Christ's story. How often do we tell these stories? I suspect not as often as we should, because we're scared to be seen as holy willies, and yet in the retelling of the stories, we find our purpose, and we find the purpose of the gospel. It's in the retelling of the stories that Christ reaches out to those who need reminders that they are loved and restored in the presence of God. Storytelling is an important part of our faith because it brings Christ to life for others. It offers Christ as part of everyday life, encircling around the community and making a space for everyone. In the weeks after Easter, it's always interesting that the stories we often find in the book of Acts are stories that tell of the gospel encountering those who feel that they are outside of the Jewish faith or outside of the communities that they're part of. And at times, we find the disciples and the apostles struggle with how the gospel story should encounter them. And yet they adapt and they grow to make room for more. And that's the story of the gospel, that Christ's love grows every time it encounters someone who needs to be told they belong. It's a story we shouldn't be afraid to tell. And there's a recognition that we should not be afraid to discover that it is us who needs to adapt to make space for those who feel they are outsiders. I have one story to tell before I finish, and I do so with a little bit of trepidation because there are some in this congregation who will have known the people and may know the family. It is, however, a story told in love and one that encourages us to tell the story of Christ in our lives. Two significant people in my time at Lough Gelly were a couple called Jimmy and Ina. When I arrived in 1998, they were in their late 70s, early 80s. I used to tease them whenever the stories of Abraham and Sarah came up that they should expect the unexpected and who knew when Isaac would arrive. As there was always a purpose for us, even if we claimed we were too old. They often told their story of how they had become part of McCain's congregation. As youngsters, they were made welcome in the church by another couple who had no children of their own. The couple always made young people feel welcome, and they were heavily involved in the running of the youth fellowship, encouraging young people to come to their home. And because of this couple, Jimmy and Ina had found church a place of real warmth, somewhere they wanted to spend Sunday and other nights of the week. Jimmy and Ina married, and because of their meeting in the youth fellowship, and went on to have their own family, but they were always involved in the youth activities around the church. Jimmy was an extremely popular scout leader, Sunday school superintendent, and former session clerk. Ina had been a guide leader and president of their guild. Even in their 80s, they were extremely supportive of anything that young people did around the church. When the Breakfast Club started for the first time, and it was a group for young people who didn't probably come to church, but usually played in the man's garden and often on a Saturday night made a lot of noise. When that club started, they needed funds. They were the first two people to give their support. They congratulated children and young people on the occasions that they led worship. Their experience of others parenting them in faith had encouraged them to offer the support and encouragement to others as they made their early steps of faith. It's probably not a dissimilar story to many of those sitting here who have found faith because somebody else encouraged them through their story. In this city of stories, maybe we need to remember those who told us the stories of faith and be pulled by that impetus of angels to share the stories we know. We cannot keep Christ's story to ourselves. It is to be retold. It is to be rediscovered. And in telling the story, it may be our love that grows and adapts to make space for others. May we share the stories we know so that Christ's love can be shared with those who are waiting to hear. Amen.